Welcome to Live Culture. I'm your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis, and this month's show, we have two guests. We're going to start off with Jeff Bergman, who's a director at Pace Prints in New York, to talk about the current gallery scene. And I have Tom Burr with me, who's an artist who has a project in the Pirelli Building in New Haven right now. But first, we're going to start with Jeff, who's on the phone. Jeff, are you there?
I am.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Martha.
Thank you for being here. So I really wanted to talk to you, partly because lately there's been so many articles about all of the gallery closings, not just in New York, but in London and L.A. as well. And it seems to be about small and mid-range galleries. There was an article in the New York Times that I think you saw, and then there was another one on ArtNet that was much more statistical.
Yes. The ArtNet article did a good job of breaking down. Basically, what they had to say was that in the last 2 years, they had cataloged, I think, 47 galleries that had gone out of business, as opposed to 13, or I should know the exact number.
No, I thought it was, 30. Well, there were 28 that I counted in the list in New York.
Yeah.
Between 2012 and 2017.
Yes, yeah. They globally put the numbers at 46 in 2015 through 2017, and then 12 between 2012 and 2015. But numbers aside, everybody, I think, can see that the number of small and mid-sized galleries that have closed in the last few years has sped up quite a bit, and I think that's a fair assessment of the situation. As for what's behind it, I think there's a number of factors, and we can sort of look at practical business side things as well as the more, I think, personal thing that comes with opening a small business.
Because there are a lot of reasons. But just to clarify, you work for Pace Prints, which is a fairly large gallery with two locations in Manhattan, and
that
you participate in art fairs. Pardon me?
Yeah. So we have two galleries in Manhattan, and we take place in at least four art fairs a year. And then we're in partnership with Pace Gallery, which has become one of the world's largest fine art galleries. So, yes, I'm speaking from a position of sort of being in the larger galleries at the moment.
And in the ArtNet article that I read, did you read that one as well?
Yeah.
So that one talked about the numbers financially. So galleries that make under $1 million lost money consistently, and galleries that were making over $1 million, had over $1 million, started making more money. And if it goes up to something like $50 million, then they're making a huge amount more, exponentially more, like up by 19% or something like that.
I think the important thing to remember is, you know, on the business side, you're essentially talking like any small business where it's retail focused. And if they can, you know, essentially, we'll talk about art and artists after this, and I don't want to sound cold and heartless, but, you know, it's high-end luxury retail at this point, right?
Right.
The people that can afford anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to $100,000 for a unique work of art, that's paying that price at a gallery that's mid-sized or even smaller, because that would be probably about the price point for a smaller or mid-sized gallery. And it's a big range, I realize. You know, they're selling to people with massive amounts of disposable income. The larger galleries, the ones who are doing $50 million plus a year, are working with a group of consumers that are probably going to curb their art buying in times of economic strife like 2008. But even still, when they're selling at those times, and they are willing, and they find buyers for pieces privately, they're still making a nice percentage off that. So they're like a broker. They're going to continue to make a hearty profit. The littler galleries who don't have those bigger contacts and, you know, that sort of entrenched collector base, they're not going to be able to participate in that sort of backroom dealing that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Except that
I was sort of surprised. I probably have a fairly naive idea about these things, but I was surprised at some of the galleries which closed, including Sonnabend, Robert Miller, Andrea Rosen, and smaller galleries like Mixed Greens that had the appearance, at least, of being robust. And also in L.A., Acme and Mark Moore closed, and in London, Vilma Gold and Wilkinson Gallery closed. I mean, I think of those as being, you know, not that small and not that, in some ways, not that experimental.
Sure, sure. Well, I think, you know, so contributing factors, I think some of the ones you mentioned, there were personal reasons, and, mm-hmm. and that's whatever, that is, that's small businesses. I think mm-hmm. with others, some of the mid-sized or smaller galleries keep losing their artists, the ones that become the money makers for the gallery, they lose their artists to larger galleries once their career becomes more established.
Right.
So there's a very good instance in which, you know, the smaller galleries are losing out.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially doing all the talent building and all
sure.
the heavy lifting.
But hasn't it always been like that? That's sort of how I assumed that things work. You start off in kind of more experimental spaces and then get picked up and move along and...
Well, I think that is true, and maybe I'm even a little naive in this situation, but I think that you don't really have to go back that far. I would say 50 years, but even really probably more like 35 years, where you're talking about an artist coming up with a gallery is most likely going to stay with that gallery
mm-hmm.
much earlier on, because there weren't as many galleries and there wasn't as much variation
mm-hmm.
Between small, mid, large market. It was
mm-hmm.
really, you know, a gallery was a gallery was a gallery for quite a while. It might have been a downtown experimental gallery and everybody knew that they were running that on the cheap. And so there probably wasn't a lot of marketing or PR being put into the work. It was more word of mouth, whereas
mm-hmm.
the 57th Street crowd, and just speaking of Manhattan here, of course, you know, they were the ones courting the collectors and curators and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
So,
yeah.
One of the things that struck me reading the New York Times article, and it's by, and I'm going to massacre this person's name, it's Robin Pogrebin who wrote it. Is that right?
I don't know the pronunciation.
Okay,
but yes,
so
I believe that's right.
Apologies to the author,
yeah.
But it was a really interesting article, and one of the things that was sort of interesting about it was how... personal the responses from the gallery dealers were about a kind of sadness about how things had changed. He or she starts off the article talking about On Stellar Ray's closing. And Candace Mady says, every day there is pressure with no end in sight to feed this bigger machine. And this is after she had expanded her gallery and included performative elements and all kinds of things and then closed it within a year. And all of the gallerists that they talked to had this kind of sadness about not being able to work more with artists and having to feed the machine and spend more time on and money on art fairs and less time working with artists, which is what they would like to do.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that that's a very blunt and honest way of looking at it from the small and mid-sized gallery dealers. I actually spoke with Candace
mm-hmm.
Briefly before, because I knew we would be speaking today,
mm-hmm.
and she spoke mostly about personal reasons for wanting to get out of that
right,
constant
right.
loop of both feeding the machine and being a young person trying to survive the life of a gallerist, really,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, most of the downtown Lower East Side galleries are open Wednesday through Sunday, so kiss your weekend goodbye.
Right.
Doing six art fairs a year. And this is something I want to zero in on because I do...
The art fairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about art fairs.
There's so much of the market building happens at the art fairs. Now,
mm-hmm.
the gallerists put on shows, and it's fantastic for both the gallerist and the artist they get to work with to have those five-week, six-week, four-week exhibitions
mm-hmm.
and to have this ever-changing cycle of exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
It gives the artist chance to show new work. It gives the gallerist chance to broaden their program. and, you know, you're adding to the dialogue. The art fair is not usually part of that dialogue. It's a long weekend in a far-flung location, and it's really a commercial enterprise. Mm-hmm. And fairs like Art Basel and Frieze have done their best to incorporate a curatorial platform into those fairs,
mm-hmm.
but it's really mostly just paying lip service to
right.
the idea of building larger art projects around or in the vicinity of an art fair to make it feel more like the Venice Biennale or something like that, so mm-hmm. that there's more to see and more to experience. But really, the art fairs have become, if you can imagine a small-sized gallery applying for and paying massive sums of money well in advance of these art fairs
mm-hmm.
on the hope, the prospect that they will do business there, the pressure is outstanding. I mean, it really
right.
is
right.
unbelievable to think that if you're just doing four a year, which is really not that many, you could potentially be laying out $25,000 to $100,000, depending on which fairs you're doing, for an art fair booth 6 months, 4 months, 3 months in advance of a fair. You know, you're out of pocket hundreds of thousands of dollars
yeah.
before you've been to the fair. So that mounting pressure, that crushing weight, that feeding that machine, I think a lot of it is there.
You know, one of the things about the art fairs also is that they can all see each other and the collectors. You're in these sort of cubicles looking at each other and wandering around, and it must get incredibly competitive and weird at various moments because you're also trying to maintain a professional facade and be friendly, and you know, it sounds really fraught to me. And having to do a lot of them as opposed to one or two sounds possibly fun. You can see people from all over the world who have other galleries and network, and that sounds okay. But to have to do four or five or six sounds like a whole nother ball game.
Well, and the larger galleries, to step into that part of the conversation, have started to build out departments devoted to the art fair
mm-hmm.
Work that needs to be done. And, you know, I don't have any numbers on how large these departments are, but there will be someone within a gallery like Zwirner
mm-hmm.
or Hauser & Wirth or possibly Pace that has just art fair logistics on their plate, and
mm-hmm.
that's their only job. Where they're planning for Dubai and Sao Paulo and Hong Kong and, of course, Basel, Miami,
mm-hmm.
New York, and wherever
right.
else they need to go. I believe the Seattle Art Fair starts in a week,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, really pushed by Paul Allen's art collecting up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there is much of an art market there, but I think a lot of the bigger dealers are concerned that if they don't show up in San Francisco and Washington,
right.
And Seattle, that they won't, when that spending starts happening, when the tech money starts spending,
mm-hmm.
That they're going to miss out. And
right.
so they're
right.
they're able to invest massively up front, just on a hope.
Right.
Really.
And
yeah.
it, so one of the things that art fairs do, of course, is that they remove the specificity of the location, so it's not like a ramble through Chelsea or going into the Lower East Side or anything else like that. And there was a nice quote, hang on a second, I'm going to look for it, from Glenn McMillan of CRG Gallery that closed. And he says, this was from a art space website, had a thing where they asked people in the art world about what's going to happen next after brick-and-mortar galleries close. And he says, there's been a shift. The acceptance of art as liquid assets. It's moved towards a much more consolidated equity investment vehicle. It's truly become an international business. It's bringing to the art market an incredible volume of money, and it puts pressure on mom-and-pop operations like ours. People are not coming to galleries. It's been a simultaneous perfect storm of the convenience and plethora of the art fairs and the Instagram mentality of seeing something and immediately having a yes or no response to something. It's not the world we signed up for. And I think that as an artist, that's not the world I signed up for either. As an artist, you know, my dream, and it's probably like a kind of, you know, that I was thinking about that board game Dream Date. It's probably a little bit unrealistic like that, but, you know, is to find a dealer that somebody who really gets my work and I really like them and we work together and in whatever that space is, they help put together shows that are, you know, beautifully organized and thoughtful, and they bring something to it. And it's not really, there is an aspect about, you know, making money, but it's not really about that. Dream of almost every artist I know is to have a really beautifully, thoughtfully prepared exhibit.
Well, and I think the time it takes and the money it takes to have a gallery that will plan 6 to 8 exhibitions a year,
yeah,
produce catalogs or literature on those exhibitions, hang them in a thoughtful way, mm-hmm, it takes quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
So we're eating our own tail at this point, right? So we're chasing the money at the art fairs so that we can put on a good exhibition,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. I think that the idea that your dream date,
my dream date, yes,
gallerist is out there is not probably unreasonable. It's not a dream, but the galleries, as I think has happened many times before, will become dispersed.
Mm-hmm.
They're huddled in a few locations around New York, but that's already changing. And it is not uncommon to head out to Bushwick to see a very good show, or to head out somewhere. You know, Elizabeth D is up in Harlem. So is Gavin Brown, you know, and they've made these moves because they got to a certain place in the market where they could, mm-hmm, where they had the strong collector base, but also that those galleries weren't trying to conquer the global art market either. They weren't opening 12 locations around the world and doing 12 art fairs a year.
Because that's not the world they signed up for.
Exactly. And yeah, so they have, through luck or through excellent choices, have not ended up like a 25-year-old mid-sized gallery that finds itself unable to sustain itself.
Okay, and hang on a second. Hold that thought, because I want to give a station announcement. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org online, and this is Live Culture. I'm Martha Willette Lewis, and I'm in conversation right now with gallerist Jeff Bergman from Pace Prints, and we're talking about the current gallery situation right now in New York and elsewhere. So anyway, sorry to interrupt you, please.
No. I think while we talk about the numbers and the money and all of this, it is important to go back to, like you said, the idea of what both the artist and the gallerist want from this exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Gallerist being a word that kind of cracks me up sometimes because I feel like it encompasses so many things, but the people who run galleries, they're business people, and they're also people, hopefully, with a great love of art,
mm-hmm,
and have an interest in curating shows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many galleries are built, you know, of these massive teams where some people only deal with the artists and some people only deal with the sales. I know of a few galleries that have models set up like that, so there are artist liaisons who are not involved in the sales.
So what do you do?
People.
What is your role? Do you get to do both? Do you not think of yourself as a gallerist?
Well, I do, but I am in an interesting position where I deal with multiples and additions.
Mm-hmm.
So I am 90-something percent sales, and
okay, the
very little of my job gets to be curatorial. But with additions and publications, we are working with the artists we're working with, showing their work, and some of them are Pace Gallery artists, some are not.
Mm-hmm.
But My goal is to put the best show on the wall I can. Sometimes the artist is involved, sometimes
mm-hmm,
their estate is involved, and sometimes it's a show just to get those new publications up on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful job because I don't have the same constraints as a gallerist with 15 artists or 20 artists on their roster or 10 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
I have 125 artists to work with.
Wow, right.
That go back 50 years, you know,
mm-hmm,
and so in January, when Pace Prints turns 50, we'll hang a show of an artist named Ernest Trova, who hasn't had an exhibition in New York, most likely, in 30-some-odd years.
Wow.
But was one of Pace Gallery's premier artists in the 1970s. So
That's kind of exciting. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, no, it should be good fun. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, and I know you know prints and the print world a little bit, it's a microcosm of the greater art world in that artists get an opportunity to make multiples for fun and profit. I like mm-hmm. to think of it that way. You know, there are some artists I know whose multiples sustain their studio practice.
Right, right.
And they...
Well, it's more egalitarian. Most people can, you know, people who might not be able to afford an original painting can afford an original print.
And that's certainly
probably
the case. And I don't want to sell what I do, but I do quite love the print market, the print world.
Yeah.
And there are so many print studios that are based in universities, educational institutions, whether it's the Nieman Center at Columbia, Tandem Press out in Madison, Wisconsin, Tamarind out in New Mexico, Graphic Studio in Florida. Those are all essentially not-for-profit institutions that are producing works with artists.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the same pressures that someone like Prince would have. You know, they can make far-reaching, outlandish prints, interesting things that they don't necessarily have to worry about
selling
what
it.
What will this sell in the marketplace, you know, quickly?
So,
but back around to the closures of small and mid-sized galleries.
Well, they keep kind of talking as if there's all these other incredibly creative options that are going to come up. And I was thinking about how galleries have been moving, you know, from Soho to down to Tribeca and out into Brooklyn, Williamsburg, further and further afield. And part of the thing about galleries was that it used to be in a more concentrated area and used to be able to walk from one to the other. There'd be like a whole neighborhood like Chelsea or like the Lower East Side. And you were mentioning...
both of those realities still exist. Chelsea and the Lower East Side, and increasingly more in Midtown, you can see 50 or 100 free art exhibitions.
Right, right.
I often remind students that come to visit the gallery that basically for the price of a bus ticket and a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich, they can come and explore, you know, from open to close, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., they could see 100 art exhibitions in New York for free.
Which is amazing. And I kind of worry when gallerists are saying things like, well, we're going to be, you know, dealing privately, or we'll still be, at, you know, available by appointment, or people, artists come up with more and more kind of baroque and creative ways of showing their work, but some of them are probably harder to find, and I worry about them not being that accessible to people who might not ordinarily go and see art or might be intimidated by it.
I think the gallery dispersal to points outside of New York or closures where galleries are moving into private dealing is, I think this is part of normal contrition and contraction, rather, is probably the right word. But I think we will continue to have a Chelsea, or if, when Chelsea becomes all resident, high-end residential and high-end retail, Lower East Side, and when that, you know, changes Bushwick, I think these things will continue to shift the way that neighborhoods in New York do. And I'm sure that the same for downtown L.A. You know, L.A.'s galleries are totally all over the city.
Yeah.
You know, there are little districts, but...
Right. No, what was nice about Bergamot Station was, because it, which is one of the places there, is that it was sort of one stop. You could park the car and walk, which was kind of unusual and nice.
Right, which I believe was recently saved from redevelopment.
Yes, it was.
Hang on. the thing is, you know, they're coming at it from, you know, they still have a very... it's in its infancy out there. You know, there are wonderful galleries out there, but not the galleries themselves, but the scene, you know, the sort of putting galleries together in places where it makes sense to do so. And as real estate shifts, the galleries will shift. I think the important thing is that the curatorial strength that was in those galleries and the artist representation doesn't just dry up.
Right.
And I don't think that's happening.
Okay.
I think there will be some fewer galleries, and there will be some more experimental galleries, and there will be some more cooperative galleries.
So,
but Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I'm going to have to wrap things up
here.
But so you don't think it's all the art fair's fault?
It's a lot the art fair's fault.
I think it's a lot the art fair's fault too.
Yeah. I mean, but rising real estate costs and the pressure of the market really. You know, if a gallery wants to stay small, it still has that option in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to be probably either privately funded or out in Bushwick or Bed-Stuy.
And I had no idea people were buying art from Instagram, which seems like an insane thing to do. As somebody who cares a lot about surfaces, I can't even, you can't see the scale. It just seems like a very, unless you already knew the artist and the work very well, it seems like a very odd way of doing it. It's like removing all the pleasure out of buying artwork, too.
Well, I hate to leave it on this note because I feel like that's what I'm doing.
It's a downer.
People who are buyers of luxury, high-end retail goods that are of a certain age group have become used to spending their money based on a JPEG rather than seeing the actual work.
Oh, Jeff. Okay.
I know.
On a positive note, I do have a positive note here. We're going to say goodbye to you, but we're going to see you again. You're going to be in New Haven for the Citywide Open Studios. You're one of the curators who's been invited to come on one of the weekends. Have you picked a weekend yet?
I'll be there the 21st, 22nd, which I think is
the independent
the galleries that are dispersed around the city.
Right.
So
that's fantastic.
Multiple locations and. I'm very excited to have
the opportunity
to come visit with New Haven artists.
Yeah, no, it's just great. So artists who are listening to this, you may see Jeff in your studio in October. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
A fait un beau voyage, ou comme c'est celui-là, quiconque il a toison, et puis est retourné plein d'usage et raison, vivre entre ses parents, le reste de son âge, quand reverrai-je hélas de mon petit village, fumer la cheminée, et en quelle saison, reverrai-je le clan. Je fumais la cheminée et en quelle saison, mais quand reverrai-je? Mais quand reverrai-je de mon petit village? Fumais la cheminée et en quelle saison, mais quand reverrai-je? Quand reverrai-je? Reverrai-je le clos de ma pauvre maison? Qui m'est une province et beaucoup d'avantages. Plus me plaît le séjour qu'on bâtit mes aïeux que des palais romains, le front audacieux. Plus que le marbre dur me plaît l'ardoise fine, plus mon Loir gaulois que le Tibre latin, plus mon petit liré que le Mont Palatin, et plus que l'air marin la douceur angevine. Mais quand reverrai-je de mon petit village fumer la cheminée, et en quelle saison, mais quand reverrai-je? Mais quand reverrai-je de mon petit village fumer la cheminée, et en quelle saison, mais quand reverrai-je? Quand reverrai-je? J'ai traversé les mers à la force de mes bras, Seul contre les dieux, perdu dans les marais, retranché dans une cale et mes vieux tympans percés pour ne plus jamais entendre les sirènes et leurs voix. Nos vies sont une guerre où il ne tient qu'à nous de nous soucier de nos sorts, de trouver le bon choix, de nous méfier de nos pas et de toute cette eau qui dort, qui pollue nos chemins, soi-disant pavés d'or. Et quand reverrai-je de mon petit village fumer la cheminée et en quelle saison? Mais quand reverrai-je? Mais quand reverrai-je de mon petit village fumer la cheminée et en quelle saison? Mais quand reverrai-je?
Hi, welcome back to Live Culture. I'm your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis, and you are listening, of course, to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org. And my second guest is artist Tom Burr, who has a piece that's up for the year in the Pirelli building, and it's a site-specific installation. And this is a good follow-up from our last conversation, because his gallery has a project where they put artists into the space of their choice in the place of their choice. Is that correct? Hello, and thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. That's right. Bortolami Gallery in New York. Stefania mm-hmm. Bortolami had, you know, thought for several years about issues that you talked about with the previous guest, mm-hmm. issues of expansion and contraction and affordability and audience.
Right.
And came up with the idea, the initiative called Artist City, to pair an artist with a city and a hopefully sort of non-conventional exhibition space mm-hmm. of that artist's choice within the continental United States as a commercial venture, mm-hmm. Which might be distinct from something like Dia Art Foundation
or
something like this.
Now, how does it work as a commercial venture? Because what you have, as I understand it, is you've taken the inside of the Pirelli building, which is pretty raw, and you've made an installation using photographs and texts and bulletin boards,
right?
Or what are being called bulletin boards? How is that commercial?
Well, you know, I mean, I think I say commercial in so much that it's an extension of a commercial gallery, mm-hmm. That it's meant to try to pay for itself. There's that effort being made.
So will the objects from the exhibit be then put into a gallery context?
Have a life afterwards, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of them were.
Most
of them were obviously designed with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
As much as my work has in the past, had some sort of perhaps not as dramatic an original setting as this one mm-hmm. in the Pirelli, Marcel Breuer designed Pirelli building in New Haven. But many of my works in the past have dealt with that notion of an original site and then their sort of mobility beyond that site.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your choice of the Pirelli building.
You know, I was trying to think of where I might want to do a project mm-hmm. in the United States. I was thinking about California, and then someone close to me had said, you know, what about New Haven? Nothing was really grabbing me about another site mm-hmm. elsewhere.
So the gallery had asked you first. They said, pick a place.
That's right.
It wasn't that you came up to them and said, I really want to do something in a large brutalist building.
That's right. There were only two or three of them that had happened prior to my project. So the space was pretty wide open for me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I often react to a space rather than sort of choosing something randomly. So
yeah.
I nothing sort of grabbed me, and somebody close to me had said, you know what, you've dealt with New Haven in your work before.
Mm-hmm.
This could be an extraordinary opportunity to do something there. And it's certainly something that I had not thought about at
right.
all.
Right. And you now, on an autobiographical note, and there are autobiographical aspects to some of your work. You grew up in New Haven?
I was born and grew up in New Haven, yes.
So this building is something that you've known for a while.
My very first job was at the Long Wharf Theater, which mm-hmm. was, you know, a couple of doors down from the Pirelli building. And so I knew it. And I also, I grew up in New Haven, in Hamden, ultimately, right mm-hmm. outside New Haven, attended Educational Center for the Arts in New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
And so this building was part of the landscape, and we looked at about 12 different possible spaces, assuming that the Pirelli building was just not an option.
Right.
Which is now owned by IKEA.
It's owned by IKEA and it's closed. You referred to it in one of the articles that I read. You were looking, you said it was not, you didn't want to do something utopian like Dia, and that you referred to New Haven as a banal city and said that it failed to produce the results it promised, and that was attractive to you. And the building itself got described in a variety of ways. One of them was I really liked was concrete corpse, and the other one was that it was a concrete envelope, which I thought was really lovely.
Yeah.
But these are qualities that you found attractive in terms of the art making because it's something that you could really sink your teeth into.
That's exactly right. I was the comment sort of about the Dia that I wasn't interested in sort of choosing a quote unquote exotic location and that would be sort of one of these kinds of pilgrimages in that
right,
way.
Right.
And the banality comes less from a description perhaps of New Haven, although that could apply. I'm not sure, but more of the fact that it had a kind of autobiographical kind of bluntness to it.
Right.
And that was interesting to me. And that was. You know, and I had dealt with in the past, you know, one of the impetuses for the project were a series of bulletin boards that I'd made in 2001 in a gallery exhibition in Berlin about that was partly about New Haven, that juxtaposed brutalist buildings by Paul Rudolph and Kevin Roach with the performing body of Jim Morrison. And so those boards were something that I wanted to revisit, but in a much more sort of theatrical and architectural and physical manner with the Pirelli building.
And included in that were there was a very strange description of your walls of your house, of your childhood home, as being like concrete and unpainted, which gives me a very weird mental picture of where you lived. But that was that gets brought into the project.
You know, there was I wanted to, you know, I called the project bodybuilding early on, and I wanted to.
Is it still called that?
It is.
Okay.
And there's a this initial phase which is on now is called. Pre-existing conditions. And I wanted to make sort
That's
of a parallel
nice.
Construction between my body, my skin, my surfaces, my biography, my my trappings, my trajectory, and this particular building and its body, its skin, its envelope, and its position.
Its envelope, yeah.
I wanted to make certain parallels that way between a building that was built and constructed in the 1960s. I was also constructed or born in the 1960s, very close to this building. So that kind of simultaneity of event is something that I was trying to sort of tease out in the installations inside the building as well.
And the surface of your childhood walls?
They're very rough. They're rough plaster walls.
So okay, sort of an so it's plaster.
Yeah. They looked a bit like sidewalks, but it's sort of a Tudor affect that was never painted. But yes.
Well, I just wanted to share a memory of my own, which is that my nursery school was in a church that Paul Rudolph had designed.
Yeah.
And it had that kind of corduroy concrete texture that the art and architecture school has downtown. And you can imagine what the playground was like with small children hitting the sides of the building.
Right.
I have memories of of feeling that surface.
Very tactile surfaces.
Yeah, very tactile, but not child-friendly.
Right. Well, that was something I was interested in. I've been interested in brutalist architecture for a long time, perhaps longer than it's become before it became sort of currently fashionable to rethink it. And part of what was, you touched on this earlier, part of what interests me about it was this notion of it being a utopian experiment and maybe not so dissimilar on some levels from something, you know, several years earlier, the Bauhaus, which is where Marcel Breuer, who designed the Armstrong, then Pirelli tire building, he studied at the Bauhaus. And the 1960s, in 1950s into 1960s and into the early 70s in New Haven and elsewhere was this sort of utopian moment where Mayor Dick Lee of New Haven really felt that social issues could be solved through infrastructure and design. And I think some of that disappointment that that could not solve certain racial and economic issues of the city, that kind of residue of disappointment, I think, clings still to the skins of these buildings. And so when someone says that a building might not be attractive, or in fact it might even be ugly, I sometimes think that's a very subjective relationship to the sort of a social unconscious about that building and that program.
Well, some of the choices that they made were truly peculiar. Like to me, as somebody who lives in New Haven, I find it endlessly sad the way the highways cut through the neighborhoods.
Right.
And that was very
controversial at the time.
And
as
it really has disrupted things in a kind of a way that it has never really recovered from.
So that interested me, and mm-hmm. that this building became sort of this emblem of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was built at the edge of the highway, for instance.
Right.
It was built to be seen... From the highway.
From the time of cars.
Armstrong Rubber, who commissioned the building, simply wanted two different buildings. They wanted mm-hmm. their research and development spaces, and then they wanted executive offices.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Mayor Dick Lee wanted it to have a more dominant, prominent presence from mm-hmm. the highway. So that's where Breuer came up with this stacked, heightened, with the gap in the middle image that you see now.
Personally, I find the building beautiful.
Yeah.
I love the hole in it.
Right.
You talked about it being amputated by IKEA.
You know,
they removed part of it.
They removed a large section to, I guess it would be the west,
mm-hmm.
that for their parking lot. IKEA was interested in the site more than the building.
Sure.
And they removed the picture it, the building was something like a sphinx to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And we still see the head and the shoulders, but the
right.
body has been removed.
Right.
And,
that's a nice image.
It was quite similar to that. And in mm-hmm. fact, Breuer talked about it in sculptural terms. You talk about the base as a plinth,
mm-hmm.
and then the head, and then the surround of grass. In
you
terms
talked
of
a head.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fascinating.
And so this body got amputated in a certain mm-hmm. way, and then sutured mm-hmm. with existing walls. A lot of pressure was put on IKEA at the time to sort of resolve this mm-hmm. and to try to save what was left of the building.
Right.
And a compromise was reached. And then they closed up the building and used the space of the former sort of research and development area that extended for their parking lot, which was primarily what they really needed to function there.
Right, right. You are listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org. I'm your host, Martha Willett Lewis. You're listening to Live Culture, and I'm in conversation with artist Tom Burr about his project at the Pirelli Building in New Haven, which is up for a year, and people can go and see this installation.
That's right.
How do they do that, and what would be...
We say it's up for a year. It's actually up through the middle of November. We signed
okay.
our lease last November.
Okay.
It took an off...
So you've been working in there.
Working in there for quite a long time, and one of the biggest issues of that time span, and I will tell people how to make an appointment to come see the project. We got this extraordinary lease from mm-hmm. IKEA. We never believed that IKEA would allow us to use this building, but they did.
There's a lot of health and safety issues involved with having the public in there.
That's
which
right.
I kind of want you to talk about.
That's
later.
Right. So getting the lease was not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But then we got quite a bit of advance press for the project and
mm-hmm.
the various city. Officials and inspectors became aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we had to answer to all sorts of codes. And we had to actually get a temporary C of O, which is only good for 6 months.
Okay.
And so we had to deal with certain health issues. We had to make sure that it had been, in fact, gone through asbestos abatement. We had to bring electricity back to the building, which we did not think we'd have to
mm-hmm.
when we were first there because of the exit signs and emergency lighting that were required. And we had to put in various railings and cordon off certain areas.
Did these constraints... They must have changed your installation to some degree and become part of the whole project. Were you originally planning on having it go up more stories than it?
We were originally allowed to use both the first and the second floor, which if you're looking at the building is the base or the plinth of that,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the gap that you spoke of, and the executive offices are on top of that. And our contract allowed us to use the first two floors. I chose not to use the second floor because it would have been next to impossible with... the budget to allow disabled people to get to the second floor.
Right.
The first floor already had a handicapped entrance that was grandfathered in that was designed by Marcel Breuer.
Mm-hmm.
So this became an accessible space to work with. So I chose not to use the second floor. The upper floors were off limits to us.
Okay. And inside, history permeates your work. And inside you have pieces from Jean Genet's May Day speech. And you have... You have a photograph of him near the urinal,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is lovely. And you also have pieces about Jim Morrison and J. Edgar Hoover and Annie Albers.
That's right.
And Annie Albers is in relation to women's work in some way with chairs.
You know,
and
I wanted
labor.
To kind of flesh out the building. I wanted to think of the building as a witness. I wanted to think
mm-hmm.
of the building as in terms of its time frame and when it was built. It was built between 1967 and opened in 1970. It opened, so it was you know, I was trying to think about situations in New Haven, what the political climate was, the social climate, the aesthetic climate in New Haven at the time. And I wanted to deal with the Black Panther murder, and but also the subsequent, year later, protests surrounding the trials that took place on the New Haven Green and the courthouse in New Haven.
There are amazing photographs from that, really remarkable pictures.
And there was an amazing exhibition that was, I think, mounted at Yale in the Art and Architecture Building or somewhere. And so I was trying to think of a way into that particular project or that particular issue in my project. And these two things came together, where the restrictions that were sort of bearing down on us from the city in terms of a railing that I was required to make that had to be to code, it had to be weight-bearing, et cetera. And I wanted it to be more than simply a railing. I wanted to use those codes and those restrictions to be part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I decided my way into the issue around what had happened in New Haven vis-a-vis the Black Panther Party protests and movement was through Jean Genet, the French poet and playwright, a white man, a queer man, a foreigner. This became a very interesting way for me, his body, to talk about this particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
So he had given this extraordinary, quote-unquote, commencement speech on the green. Actually, he did not read it. He was uncomfortable reading.
I was going to ask, first of all, Somebody must have translated it for him, and then somebody else actually did the reading?
It was translated. It was later published. It was translated, and one of the Panther members read it, with Genet standing next to him.
Okay.
Genet had been in the country for almost 2 years before that. He came in illegally, had been denied a visa through our friend J. Edgar Hoover, and he came in through Canada, and he was working in Berkeley with Angela Davis and other people, and then he was in Chicago. All of this was in support of the Black Panther Party movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came to New Haven. And there's a wonderful sort of zine or publication of this that's in print, Sunshine Press, I believe, and Allen Ginsberg does this beautiful introduction to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the entire speech is on these railings. I had a given railing length because there was a particular area I needed to create, to bring up to code. And there was a particular speech that I didn't want to edit. So I brought these two things together.
That's really wonderful. But so part of the your gallery, or you had that you had to pay for the railing?
That's right. Our budget, and
we
didn't have outside funding. It was there was a budget from the gallery, from me, from our work.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized that these codes and restrictions that were starting to eat up our budget. And that's when another reason I started to sort of conceptualize them. Turn them into artwork and try to make them a very pronounced statement about the notion of access.
Right. And text with images is a really important part of your work.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
And this is a sort of interesting extension of that. Have you ever done anything like making a metal object with writing on it
I've made large-scale sort of architectural elements. I've never done exactly this, and I've never used text quite in this way. It's on the top rail. It's a black steel armatures or framed railing that mimics in some ways the iron fences of New Haven, the X formation in the middle.
And it's permanent. It's going to stay in the building?
No, it'll leave when I leave. I'm not giving IKEA my railing. But
I kind of liked the idea of it being left there, this sort of statement by Jean Genet floating into the space of the abandoned Pirelli building.
I mean, anything could happen,
but
I want to see it have another life.
Yeah.
I thought a lot about that. The railing is a work by itself from end to end, but it can mutate and change. It could be all in one line. Right now, it sort of zigzags around this particular area that Breuer called the depression, which is where their IT office was, or room at the front of the building. It's sort of sunk down about a foot below the other level, and that's why we had to create a railing there. And similarly, the building had been gutted. These two floors had been gutted when they took that section down that we were just talking about. And so you really couldn't tell what was what in terms of rooms. But you could tell where the public restrooms were, because there was a certain tile floor that was still left there, washrooms and restrooms. And these were also required to have some sort of cordoning off around them so that people wouldn't trip off them, because there's a lip of about three-quarters of an inch.
Yeah.
So I designed these sort of more temporary-looking railings based on the work of Saul LeWitt, who is also a nearby resident, and his studio is nearby, and his widow, Carol, has become a great friend and supporter of the project. So I wanted to sort of incorporate his notion of variation and play into these. And that's where you'll find also, I thought of them as stage sets, these sort of open bathroom spaces.
Right. Which I really like the idea of, there's something about places that used to have a stall.
Right.
And for something that's this sort of incredibly private act normally. And
they're almost like glass boxes in a certain way.
Yeah.
They're under complete sort of surveillance in a way. So, and I did pull down a few objects from the upper floors.
There are objects, there's detritus up there.
There's detritus. You know, I brought some things, as I was actually technically not allowed to go up there.
Mm-hmm.
I did do
we
that.
We won't tell.
We didn't, you know, I had to have a long conversation with IKEA to convince them that I wasn't trying to spoil the building in any way, but I was very, very interested in these particular objects, two of which were restroom doors that I brought down that are coupled with this image of J. Edgar Hoover in one of these scenarios, the urinal partition that is together with a young image of Jean Genet and an older image of Jean Genet.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are two of these other bathroom elements or rooms, tableaus that deal with Annie Albers as well, and another one with Jim Morrison, as you said.
And the Annie Albers one deals with women and labor. And New Haven, of course, is a big former manufacturing site, but also IKEA being next door,
right,
and manufacturer of chairs and furniture.
I was thinking about all those things. I wanted there to be some moment where the odd history of the Bauhaus, you know, crashed into this strange trajectory of IKEA.
Right.
And this notion of modernism and trickle-down modernism and affordability.
Interesting how they kind of link up.
So Annie interested me. I've always been interested in Annie Albers' work, but she and I started to think a bit more about it, and I thought about Annie Albers also attending the Bauhaus at the same time as Marcel Breuer, who designed the building. Annie Albers, who came to the Bauhaus wanting to be a painter, and because she was a woman, could only study textile design. So again, this utopian moment is perhaps only utopian for certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And as a woman, she had to also deal with extreme codes and restrictions. Of course, she became probably the most important textile designer of the 20th century. And then it also interested me that, you know, she did live in New Haven, and her studio was not far away from this building for most of her life until her death in Orange, Connecticut. So that kind of geographical coincidence was something that I was trying to layer into all of these figures or these characters that started to enter the space.
You know, the city of New Haven has a kind of unfortunate slogan, which is New Haven, where it all happens, which it's kind of damning. It's not as bad as the state of Connecticut has one that's, what is it? It's Connecticut closer than you think, which sounds kind of ominous and apologetic at the same time.
Right.
But if you go to the information booth in downtown New Haven, what they tell you about the history of the place is much less interesting than your take on it. I think they should consult with you.
Right.
J. Edgar Hoover, Jean Genet, Annie Albers, and Jim Morrison.
And Jim Morrison, yeah.
Yeah. And Jim Morrison, you've worked with him before.
Jean Genet, and also Jim Morrison. And as I said, the impetus for this project on some level were these boards I had made in Berlin, and Jim Morrison was in those boards. And I was thinking about surface. I was thinking about skin. I was thinking about corduroy brutalism. I was thinking about sensuality and sexuality.
Right, because he's famous for being removed for obscenity during a performance.
And that's right. So in December of 1967, in the New Haven Arena, which was then closed and taken down in favor of the New Haven Coliseum, a Rich and Dinkaloo building, which was then itself taken down. Next to the Knights of Columbus building. These were buildings figured in this bulletin board. So then when I have the opportunity to do something this in the Breuer building, which actually has a view of the Knights of Columbus and where the Coliseum was,
it's fantastic.
Pull that two-dimensional work into three dimensions. And so Jim had performed, he was caught making out with some girl backstage.
Mm-hmm.
He was maced. The police didn't realize he was a celebrity, or in fact he was Jim Morrison, and then he started this rant on stage about the men from New Haven in the little blue suits, and they came on stage and actually arrested him there. So this was a potent myth of New Haven.
This is fascinating, and I really wish we could carry on for longer, but we're running short on time, so I really want to make sure that people know how they can see this. It's free and open to the public.
We have asked you to contact the gallery because we have a restriction in terms of how many people we can have there at a time. So it's bortolami.com, and on that website you'll find Artist City. And then it'll explain how you can make an appointment with Emma Fernberger, who's with the gallery.
That's fantastic. And your gallery has this project somewhat in response to some of the things I was talking about with Jeff, in the sense that they are attempting to expand their exhibition structure without opening full-scale operations in different places.
That's right.
And they also give unbelievable opportunities to artists, because this is really tremendous.
I think, as I started by saying, a commercial venture, but it's also about trying to think through some of the boredoms and banalities of exhibition making now, and the structures that we're in because of art fairs, etc., and the time frames, trying to make it more interesting for artists and also for an audience.
Thank you so much, Sean, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. Join us next month for the next edition of Live Culture. You were listening to WPKN, and I'm your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis. Goodbye.
Support for WPKN comes from Evergreen Berry Farm, a pick-your-own berry farm in Watertown, Connecticut, growing blueberries, black and red raspberries, and blackberries. They are a Connecticut Northeast Organic Farming Association pledge farm committed to soil health and biodiversity. Open every day from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. during July and August. More information at evergreenberryfarm.com or by calling 860-274-0825 for the berry update.
This is Hazel Kahn inviting you to tune into North Fork Works on Wednesday to hear journalist and millennial Gianna Volpe talk about why she came to the North Fork, why this is the place she most wants to live, and what she must do to remain a career journalist on the East End of Long Island. If you can, please join us on Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Thank you.
City Lights Gallery in Bridgeport hosts the 7th annual same-sex exhibit, running from July 20th to August 26th. The exhibition explores LGBT themes as well as provocative art about personal freedom, identity, and the concept that love is love. City Lights Gallery is located at 265 Golden Hill Street. City Lights also produces the monthly Bridgeport Flea Market, the third Saturday of every month, at 1123 Main Street in Bridgeport. And save the date. This year's Bridgeport Arts Trail will be held on November 9th through the 12th.
Creative Arts Workshop, located in New Haven, Connecticut, has been serving artists of all arts, painting, photography, printmaking, and more. More information about the Creative Arts Workshop is available at www.creativeartsworkshop.org or at 203-562-4927.
Hi, I'm Lou with Citizens Campaign for the Environment, here to tell you how you can protect our water by properly disposing of unused prescription medications.
Prescription medications? What does the way I dispose of my old drugs have to do with protecting our water?
Everything. Most people still don't know that the old method of flushing unused medications contaminates Long Island Sound with steroids, hormones, and antibiotics.
Wow.
This affects our drinking water, rivers, harbors, and it affects our aquatic wildlife too.
That's awful. I want cream and sugar in my coffee, not steroids and antidepressants. Pharmaceuticals in the water can't be good for fish. What can I do to help?
Well, the good news is that towns across the state are offering new locations for residents to safely and anonymously dispose of their unused and expired drugs. If your town does not have a disposal program, you can always crush tablets or empty capsules into the garbage.
How do I find out more?
Visit citizenscampaign.org to find a safe disposal location near you, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
I get it. Don't flush your drugs.
Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven has been helping adults learn to read and write or to speak English for over 40 years. Literacy Volunteers trains tutors who provide classes for adults in reading, writing, and English conversation at locations throughout the community. More information about our programs and volunteer opportunities is available at 203-776-5899 or at www.literacyvolunteers.org. lvagnh.org. Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven, 40 years of empowering adults through literacy.
Neighborhood Housing Services of New Haven has been turning renters into home buyers for more than 37 years, transforming homes and neighborhoods, training resident leaders, and helping first-time home buyers. Neighborhood Housing Services of New Haven helps create stability and makes the American dream of home ownership possible. More information about Neighborhood Housing Services of New Haven is available by visiting nhsofnewhaven.org or calling 203-562-0598.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, serving communities in Fairfield, New Haven, Litchfield, and Suffolk counties, and streaming to the world at WPKN.org.
What a story! What a story! What a story! What a story! What a story!